From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past year during the pandemic. As reported by our colleague Beth Adams, COVID-19 combined with social and political unrest has created a perfect storm for people struggling with eating disorders. Nearly 1 in 10 Americans have an eating disorder, and there has been a surge in cases during the pandemic. As we'll discuss this hour, they are diseases of disconnection, meaning patients are unable to accurately make sense of their internal and interpersonal experiences. The isolation and uncertainty of the pandemic has only exacerbated that disconnection. The National Eating Disorders Association reports a 70% increase in requests for help during the last 12 months. Local clinical professor of nursing Mary Tantillo has written a new book that explores how to help young adults recover from eating disorders. Tantillo is the director of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. Her research over the last decade supports a multifamily therapy group approach. This hour, we discuss that process. We hear the story of a young woman in recovery, and I'd like to welcome our guests. Mary Tantillo is with us, the author of the new book, Reconnecting for Recovery, Multifamily Therapy Group for Young Adults with Anorexia Nervosa. Mary, welcome back to the program. It's always good to have you.
Well, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
And welcome to Alyssa Morales, a young adult in recovery and a private duty licensed practical nurse, in private duty, I should say. Alyssa, welcome. Thanks for being with us again.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having us here today.
And Michelle Morales, a parent peer mentor for the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. Michelle, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Evan, as well. I'm glad to be here.
Alyssa, how are you doing these days?
I'm doing okay. I'm managing. The pandemic has definitely thrown some new loopholes for the eating disorder and also for recovery, but it's good to have such a great team behind me to help stay connected.
Yeah, and I think we first met in 2015, Alyssa, and you know, heard your story about what you've gone through. But if you don't mind, if you could just take the audience through it a little bit here. Take us back to when you sort of first recognized that there was a challenge, a problem, and how you worked through it.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with anorexia when I was 12 years old. I was a seventh grader. It kind of came out of nowhere in the sense of that I just started having these behaviors and this weight loss that I wasn't even very cognizant of where it was coming from. I was then referred to University of Rochester and their adolescent medicine department. And I started being under the care of Dr. Richard Kripe, and I was able to go through treatment, all levels of care from inpatient to partial hospitalization to residential. And I was kind of in and out of care for a few years until I began recovery a couple years ago, and I've been in recovery for about, I'd say, 3 years. But recovery is not linear. It has its ups and downs, and the pandemic has definitely shifted the way that we access care, the way that care is provided. A huge part of eating disorder care before the pandemic was in person, and a lot is virtual now. So reaching out for support looks very different. It's received very differently, but it's so great to be able to live in Western New York. I'm very grateful for that and for the support to kind of help manage those shifts while also keep me on the path towards recovery.
Every person's story, of course, is different, but I know that there are some things that may be commonly misunderstood, and we've talked about this with you before, Alyssa, but let me ask you again to let our audience know when they try to understand an eating disorder and what someone may be going through, what do you think is most commonly misunderstood?
I think the thing that's most commonly misunderstood would be that that it's something that we can control. Because you think about it, when you're born, you just innately you're born learning eating. You're born eating, and you know how to do it. And then the eating disorder steps in at some point, and it completely rewires your brain. And there are points when you're sick where you just look at, you know, your caregivers, you look at yourself, and you just don't know how to push through. Like, I know how to physically, you know, pick up a fork to my mouth, but to kind of move through that and get myself to eat enough to sustain and to remain connected to those around me, I would say that's the biggest disconnection, that it isn't as easy as just, you know, eating a hamburger or having breakfast. There's a lot more that goes on internally for the person.
Yeah, and a few years ago on this program, I heard from a listener, I still remember the email that someone sent saying, you know, that they felt like what they were learning was that they had oversimplified their understanding of eating disorders, that their assumption, if I can remember what they had written in the email, was that, well, this is really just about societal pressure to be thin, and it's nothing much more than that, and just be comfortable with your body, and kind of had oversimplified it. Do you find that gets sort of commonly misunderstood too, that's always the reason, or that's what the root is always going to be?
All the time, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Especially being a young adult in recovery, I'm kind of at the point now where if I meet someone new or start a new friendship or relationship, that bringing up the eating disorder is a part to kind of keep them connected to who I am and where I am in my life. But the biggest thing they get is just, or the response that I get is usually just like, huh, I thought it was, you know, like just for, I know this is a horrible cliche, but like just for kind of like white women or rich white women, and that it's just something that you just have to look in the mirror and just accept yourself, when really that it's very dismissive to someone who has an eating disorder to hear that. But then it is kind of, you know, we take a step back and take a deep breath and have to say, no, this is really what it's about.
Mary's book, which was a collaboration with two others, is timely, and we're going to get to that in just a moment here. But Alyssa, for the last 12 months here, one of the things that I'm sure Mary will be able to talk more about is the challenge that isolation can bring, or disconnection, you know, a disease of disconnection. What has the last 12 months been like for you, and maybe what's been the most difficult aspect of the last 12 months for you?
I would definitely say the isolation, but then also just kind of how the world collectively responded to the pandemic, in the sense that all of us didn't know what was about to hit us or what we were going to go through. But for a person in recovery, that's a huge unknown. And it's a very scary space to step in. And I remember when the pandemic first started, actually, I was in partial. I was at the Healing Connection. And the week I got discharged is when we had to quarantine. But even shifting from that space of care around me for most of the week, most parts of the days, to stepping into an intensive outpatient setting that was virtual, I immediately became responsible for all of my meals, all of my snacks. And I also lived alone. And as a nurse, working in a COVID setting, you don't have that access to your family that maybe you would if your job had furloughed you home, or if you worked in a different setting. So being separated from my supports physically, but then also being separated from the center where I was getting care from and having it done virtually, definitely impacted my ability to persevere in my recovery, but then also like my willingness as well. I started to get exhausted and tired, and definitely needed, you know, to get more creative about support.
Yeah, Alyssa, Mary Tantillo said to our Beth Adams that when you're a person with an eating disorder, your enemies are uncertainty, ambiguity, and unpredictability. And if we go back a year ago this week, and really a year ago, I think Sunday or Monday, is when I just remember I was hanging out with my boy and seeing an NBA game, literally players walk off the court in the middle of the game. And the league announced in the middle of a night of games, any teams that want to walk off the court, you can walk off right now because the season's about to be suspended. You can finish the game you're on, but we're done. And just seeing it like that. Now, of course, I've been reading and thinking about it for a long time, up to, you know, March 8th, March 9th last year. And then I, you know, within days, we were talking about pulling our kids out of school, and we were talking about trying to figure out a summer where my son probably wouldn't have a summer camp and probably wouldn't play on a soccer team, and I probably wouldn't coach on a soccer team. These are all privileged problems, but they are massively filled with uncertainty. And for me, I needed just to sit down. I believe, if I remember correctly, I had a good little cry, and then I said, what are we going to do about this? Like, everybody's life is about to change in humongous ways. Yeah, I've got this almost 8-year-old. His life's about to change, and I'm not somebody with an eating disorder. So when Mary Tantillo says to our Beth Adams, Alyssa, that this is the enemies for this disease are often uncertainty, ambiguity, unpredictability, how intense did that feel, that uncertainty that we all felt? How intense was that for you?
It was incredibly intense. For me, the last year when I was in treatment, just as the pandemic hit, I was not prepared for the gravity of that relapse that I had been in. And then I had been in treatment for about 4 months, and the pandemic was brewing, and but it was the strongest I'd ever felt. Out of all my years being sick and being in recovery and transitioning in and out of care, I had felt so strong. And then to be released from care and to watch the whole world shut down and shift, it was the scariest thing I think I've ever felt in my recovery, because it was not only, you know, the shifts of jobs and you know, and family life and all of that, but it was all of that plus trying to keep myself alive and to do it well. Mm-hmm. And that was insurmountably difficult.
What has buoyed you the most in the last year?
If I had to be honest, I would say my support system. Definitely my mother. She's always my right-hand woman. Mary has been so helpful. We've talked a lot during this past year, I think more than we have any other years. And then the support of my boyfriend and everyone that I live with and spend my time with. Just, it really takes a village, and all of these people have been holding me together and reminding me, you know, what I need to continue to do to stay healthy and to move on that path that I was on.
Yeah, Mary's book, we're going to, a little later in the hour, I'll read a section that sort of models how to have conversations, how therapists might approach conversations, and how relationships can be impacted, friendships, romantic relationships. I mean, you mentioned it yourself, that when you talk to people about having an eating disorder, not everyone reacts the same, and a lot of people come in without very much understanding. And it sounds to me like you've got that solid support, whether it's your boyfriend, your friends. Do you feel like the people around you have been patient and wanted to understand more than just sort of judging or assuming?
Oh my gosh, yes, yeah. And I think it's a universe thing. You know, I couldn't have picked the people in my life, but watching even my mother, kind of from, you know, where the treatment module was just about 10 years ago to where it is now, watching her undergo that process with patience. And I realized, you know, a year ago when I was in the better part of my recovery, and I was so used to, you know, having her just understand at the fly and be there to support me and know what to say, and then trying to, because of the pandemic, you know, shift some of that support to ask for that support from my boyfriend. It has taken a lot of conversations and hard ones and disconnections and repairs to kind of help him to understand, you know, what it is, what an eating disorder truly is, and what it means to recover from one. But kind of, I think one of the blessings of the pandemic as well has been able to have those conversations and allow for that time and that patience and that space, because I don't think that I would be here in the place that I'm at if I didn't have my mother and if I didn't have my boyfriend working so effortlessly to love me and to support me through this.
Well, I'm going to turn to your mother and Mary in just a second here, but do you find, Alyssa, given that, you know, you've been in recovery for you know, a significant amount of time now, you're clearly someone who is thoughtful about the disorder, about how it's impacted you. Do you find that, especially in the last 12 months, that when you are feeling that uncertainty, that intensity, that challenge, are you, I don't know if better is the right word, but are you more able to sort of vocalize that to the people who you need support from, that I'm feeling vulnerable, I'm feeling nervous about this, I'm struggling with this, or is there still a concern about sort of keeping that in?
I would say a little bit of both. I definitely, you know, through the pandemic have had to push myself in ways to ask for support when feeling all of, you know, the crazy confusing emotions that you were talking about, you know, like with your son, with the changes of the pandemic, is that if we don't talk about those things, regardless of whether you have an eating disorder or not, they are going to manifest in some way, and usually unhealthy ways. So it definitely took a lot of exercising of, you know, like, I'm feeling this and I don't want to talk about it because I know that my eating disorder could take care of it for me. But then there was the battle of, you know, the exhaustion and saying sometimes, you know, I don't want to do this. Like, recovery is too hard on top of this pandemic. But to know that there is that space between those two responses and that I can choose, and knowing that I will be supported and loved and held no matter which one I choose, that has continued to help me veer towards at least naming what I'm feeling in order to keep me connected and to help me to continue to move forward.
Well, Michelle Morales, Alyssa is an amazing woman, and I suspect you're pretty proud.
Well, more than proud, but, you know, she is the strong, courageous woman she is because she has battled her eating disorder, and she knows what it means to fight for her life. And out of that, there's been beautiful gifts that I truly, as a parent, you know, we have our, you know, you know, we know the potential of our child, but this has gone far beyond whatever potential I thought she could have, for sure.
What has the last 12 months been like for you, you know, navigating the uncertainty that we all did, but also thinking about Alyssa and thinking about what she might be going through?
Well, Evan, my position, Dr. Tantillo is my boss, but I'm a parent peer mentor, so yeah. I work with many families in the community, and it has definitely had a toll on individuals. We've seen definitely an increase in individuals suffering from this illness, and this isolation piece, you know, I kind of, you know, you think that, okay, we're all together as a family, you know, so you would think that, you know, there'd be more connection. But actually, it's created, you know, not only the isolation from the outside world, but even within our family systems, we've kind of had to compartmentalize ourselves within our families in order to continue the roles that we would have had on the outside world. I was just thinking the other day about we were in multifamily, Mary and I, and one of the individuals was sharing with them, you know, about how their illness became worse. In isolation. Mm-hmm. And they said what was happening was, like, I was in school and I was having very negative thoughts, but I was able to be engaged in school. It kind of distracted me. You know, I'd have these thoughts, but then I'd go on doing something else, feel better about what I was doing, and I would go on. And then the isolation hit, and now I'm home in my bedroom by myself with these thoughts, and I just started acting on them because they were so intense that, you know, and there wasn't anything there to help distract me. So, you know, that was a, you know, pretty tremendous insight and just understanding of how the isolation is affecting us.
And Michelle, are you finding that it is more cases like that where someone's existing illness or disorder has flared up and intensified, or are there a significant amount of diagnoses of new cases?
I think it's a combination, Evan, to be honest. Like in the case of the person that I was just speaking of, they didn't, you know, they were having maybe a little bit of depression beforehand. Maybe they were an anxious person to begin with, so they didn't necessarily have an eating disorder. But the onset of the isolation kind of propelled them towards that as a solution to what the underlying things that were going on for them. And had that isolation not been there, I don't know if they would have, you know, it would have propelled them into having this illness. Then there's our, of course, like Alyssa is an example where, you know, the uncertainty, the ambiguity of the environment that we're living in, just on that pressure that exists around us every day. So if somebody is in recovery, it makes sense when, you know, there's this tremendous pressure from the outside to, you know, challenge them and how they can, you know, revert back into their illness because of it.
And before I turn to Mary, Michelle, do you find that when you are working with people with this disorder, that they and their loved ones know that they have an eating disorder, or is there sometimes a surprise at the diagnosis?
Generally, there's a lot of surprise around it, for sure. Like I said, the individual, the example I gave, you know, that person didn't understand what was going on for them internally.
Sure.
So, and then to be able to communicate that to the people around you is as they're becoming more and more sick, and as we learn, it's a disease of disconnection. As they're becoming more disconnected from themselves, they can't always voice that, and so the families aren't going to know until quite on down the line, you know, what's going on for them as the families are experiencing the disconnection that's happening.
Well, Mary Tantillo is the author, a co-author of a new book, Reconnecting for Recovery is the Goal. The book and the approach is Multifamily Therapy Group for Young Adults with Anorexia Nervosa. Mary, who did you want to write this book for?
Well, the first thing that popped into my head was families and people, practitioners, and with the idea that it's not either or. I tried to write it with Daniel and Jennifer, my co-authors, in a way that anybody could pick up the book and hopefully understand it. So I would say families and patients and providers working collaboratively as a team is so important to all three of us on the phone call and to many of us in the profession. So I would say all those parts of the team I was trying to aim for.
What have you observed and what do you find that our community is experiencing with this disorder in the last 12 months, especially, Mary?
Well, I agree with what Michelle said, that there's new cases, unfortunately, and also folks who are doing really well are having a really tough time. And so we are advantaged in Western New York because of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center, because we have a continuum of care that includes, you know, the Children's Hospital and the Healing Connection and all the things that Michelle and life coaches and peer mentors, we have more than what the average area would have in the country. At the same time, what Michelle and Alyssa said is there's still so much misunderstanding of what eating disorders are, like their vanity, that's what people might say, or they can't make sense of it. So I think more education is definitely needed for providers. It's not their fault. They're not getting education in their basic training, a lot of providers. I actually, you know, Michelle, I have parents and I have patients who actually understand eating disorders better than the average provider because the disciplines don't have education. So that's definitely needed. And then the aloneness, creating ways of connecting, I think, is so important. And some of that is, like, obviously your own, your professional treatment team, but then your family, your close others. As I was listening to Alyssa and Michelle, I'm not sure, Evan, if you know, and you may, but that if you just took isolation and aloneness separate from the eating disorder, just on its own, the research has supported that it leads to premature death and to physical and mental health problems on its own. And it's as high a risk factor for premature death as if you were smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So that's separate from having an eating disorder. And an eating disorder is the most lethal psychiatric illness outside of opioid dependence. So if you combine aloneness or isolation with having an eating disorder, it's a disaster. It's a disaster waiting to happen. And as they said already, there's lots of disconnections that go on internally for the person from their own body, from their own feelings. And they're having trouble processing information themselves. And then all that kind of interplays with close others who want to help, but the close others can't make sense of what's happening either. So a lot of it is naming disconnections that are happening inside or between people, finding routes towards more connection with others in your own family, whether that's your family of origin, your family of choice, and then finding a professional treatment team that will work collaboratively with your family and with you as a person in recovery to close the gap on aloneness. I'm hoping that all makes sense. All those different things along with education.
Oh, my gosh, yes. And you know, Mary, I just want to touch on the isolation component right now because so many of our listeners they may be feeling this themselves. They know someone, perhaps in a nursing home, perhaps someone who has just admitted to feeling depression. I have a parent who said that to me for the first time in their lives. I think I'm depressed in the last 12 months. And so, Mary, my sense of what this pandemic has done, I am not at all seeking to make a political statement. I mean, this has been a massive challenge on the public health level, on the government level and policy side, on the economy, on small businesses. But when you talk, as you do, about just the impact of isolation, you know, set eating disorders aside, set other illnesses aside, just what isolation can do. My sense is that we have been a little, We've been a little too flippant when we talk about the importance of reconnecting, reopening, or at least finding some way to break out of what has been a cycle of isolation, whether it's in schools, whether it's getting kids back in the classroom or elsewhere. I think the mental health challenges are a little bit, because sometimes people say, oh, well, you just want to go out to eat in a restaurant again, or you're just bored, just make another meal at home. Or that is not what I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about exactly what you're discussing. And I wonder if we've missed that a little bit in the last 12 months. What do you think?
Oh, I would agree with you. Like, relationships aren't just niceties. People go out to do things because they are hungry for connection. Honestly, I don't see it any different than having thirst or having hunger for food. We hunger for connection with others. I mean, evolutionarily, we would not have survived if we didn't have that hunger for close others. That's how people literally survived back in the day and now in the face of this pandemic. So I think that's why having something virtual, it's not the same as being together. So obviously, if we can find ways of being together masked and have social distance, but not let that social distance turn into social isolation. And that's what happens with eating disorders, because the eating disorder makes you think in extreme ways, right? And if you're not eating properly or sleeping properly, you're already going to kind of isolate anyway. But then you add all the other things going on in the environment, and it only further amplifies the potential for aloneness and disconnection.
Mm. So after our only break of the hour, I'm going to ask Mary to take us through some of the themes of the book, and we're going to read a little bit from it. She's the author of a new book on reconnecting for recovery, helping people, families, even therapists and providers understand eating disorders and create that path to recovery. So Mary Tantillo is with us. Alyssa Morales and Michelle Morales are with us. You heard Alyssa describe her story. It's hard to think of anyone who is more poignant and articulate at helping us all understand this than Alyssa and Michelle, of course, doing such great work supporting her and supporting those in our community who are working through this. So let's take that only break, and we're right back with them next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times report that there is new evidence that top aides in the Cuomo administration actively sought to cover up the statistics on the number of deaths from nursing home residents to COVID-19. What does the Cuomo administration say about this new revelation? What does it tell us about the path forward for nursing home care? We'll talk about it Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Daniel and Jane on the phone. Jane, stay there. I want to get both of these calls, and I'm going to start with Daniel. Thank you, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, this is Daniel. I want to heap praise on Michelle and Mary for help they've had with my daughter a few years ago, Emil. And what they do is great. I'm very thankful for them, and I think they're right about not a lot of people are educated in eating disorders. They think it's a joke or something you can get through very quickly, but it's not.
Daniel, how is your daughter doing?
She's doing a lot better. It's been a couple of years, though, but still have moments, where that comes back. Not roaring back, but it's always there in the background.
What did you have to learn about this, about her eating disorder, that maybe you were... that you didn't know or sort of had incorrect assumptions about going into this, Daniel?
I had virtually no knowledge of the eating disorder, what it would have involved, how hard it was, extremely emotionally difficult for the person involved, and then they have also the burden of educating people around them or getting them to places where they can be educated.
Well,
Michelle is great about that.
Michelle, do you want to add to some of what Daniel is saying there? Go ahead.
Well, first of all, thank you, Daniel. I so appreciate that. I to expound upon what Daniel's saying is, it's just again, we come into it with preconceived notions of what we think this is, or we may come into it thinking, okay, this is an illness, I'm getting the help, and my loved one is just going to go on, you know, and get, you know, and recover. And we don't really understand the magnitude of the disconnections that happen for the person within the person and how much it takes in order for them to reconnect. I mean, it's, you know, they are basically neurobiologically rewiring their brain, which is a monumental task to do on top of just trying to live your everyday life. And, Dan, you want to say more to that? Like for,
I agree. It's just the task that the person has just to get people around them to even acknowledge that and then try to get them educated a little is monumental. And sometimes they're in denial. They use the eating disorder to overcome some issues in their life. So not only are they're losing that to deal with other stresses in their life, you know, when they're in recovery, they're dealing with the eating disorder, and then now they're faced with what may be in the background that's really hurt them for, I don't know how many ongoing years and years. So it's really hard, and I really got to thank Michelle.
Well, Daniel, thank you. Thanks for the phone call. I know they appreciate that, and certainly gratifying to hear that your daughter is doing well, all things considered. Mary Tantillo, before I take the next phone call, do you just want to add a little bit to what Daniel said there?
I want to thank Daniel for coming on and saying that. It's very hard to understand that people have this idea that when you get sick, you take a pill or you even go to therapy and then you're fine, right? As Daniel said, these illnesses are also, they're neurobiological, like Michelle said, but they also are developmental. So that you might come into the illness when you're an adolescent, and with the best treatment, what could happen is everything seems to get quiet for a while and you get better coping skills. And for some people, that's it. They terminate. But for others of us, just like diabetes or asthma, some of us, it might, you know, you cruise up to another developmental period, let's say going from high school to college, and there's lots of angst and lots of anxiety and pressure, and the way you're processing it and the expectations you have for yourself are so high, you have perfectionism, and then you get stressed again, and the eating disorder starts to come on in terms of thoughts. So as human beings, we ruminate about different things, right? Well, it just so happens that the way genes and environment work with an eating disorder is you start worrying about your body shape and weight. There's underlying tremendous anxiety. It gets manifested in your body, right? And how you're concerned about your body and weight. And that can happen at different points in our lives where others might be taking things for granted. Oh, isn't this great? We're going to college. For someone that has a history of an eating disorder, it's extra stressful. And as Dad said, you might start seeing some symptoms. And the most important thing, though, is you can track those symptoms quicker when you have good relapse prevention skills and family around you and friends, and they know kind of what your triggers are. You can work together to more quickly identify those things and maintain yourself on the right track.
Well, Mary, Chris sends a note saying, is there a link between social media and the illness such that part of recovery calls for reducing or eliminating exposure to social media?
That's an excellent question. And yes, there's research to say that if you are vulnerable, right, if you already have genetic vulnerability to disordered eating or body image disturbance or eating disorders, and you're the young person or even a person in midlife who's watching a lot of this media that puts our bodies down, lowers body esteem, makes us question ourselves, that's happening every 5 minutes, right? Yes, those people can internalize the idealized thinness. And that can be a part of what's going on, but you usually have vulnerability first. And yes, I think for kids and adolescents, and even for young adults, knowing what they're viewing on Instagram or TikTok or what media sites they're going to, because there's pro-ANA, unfortunately, sites that are still out there, or pro-BN sites, bulimia sites, I think it's important to know that and to help them limit that and get rid of the bad messaging and introduce social media sites that promote body esteem and self-esteem, and there are a lot of them. We share them with patients all the time. So yes, absolutely. In and of itself, can it create eating disorders all by itself? No. There's genetic vulnerabilities and then environmental stressors that are acting together. And that social media stressor is one of a number that doesn't make it any easier for someone who is already at risk.
Yeah, and one more question, then I'm going to take Jane in Rochester on the phone. Alyssa Morales, can you just give me a sense for how you see social media as a tool, either for good or for ill, regarding eating disorders? And you might be on mute, Alyssa. So,
can you hear me now?
I can. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think for eating disorders, it is negative. And I know that's kind of hard to say, like, oh, you know, it's black or white. But when I was struggling with an eating disorder, Instagram, you know, Facebook, all of that kind of propelled me. There was always something, like, even if it was subtle, that the eating disorder would latch onto, whether it be, you know, like a summer picture of my best friend in a bikini, or just some girl that I saw, or some recipe. And eventually, about 2 years ago, I cut ties with all social media, because even though I was in recovery, it continued to ignite that voice and kind of, you know, keep that door open. And I think for even just for adolescents who don't struggle with eating disorders, that there needs to be a lot more monitoring for mental health, especially during this COVID season. But with eating disorders, it definitely gets taken to another level and can really impact someone's recovery or their movement towards healing or towards sickness, depending on where they are in their journey.
Chris, great question. Thank you for that, and a really important point. Jane in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, first, I just want to say Mary is amazing. We're so lucky to have her in Rochester. She's devoted her career to this. I helped out a teeny bit with Sage House back when she was working with Sage House, and she's so impressive in her devotion to this whole field of work, which is a very difficult one. I had a really severe eating disorder, binge eating disorder, for 17 years in my 20s and 30s. I'm in my 70s now. And I love to be able to tell the story that you don't have to worry that you're going to have this for the whole rest of your life necessarily. I ended up with a very profound spiritual experience at the age of 37 after all those years of battling and having ups and downs, as Mary described. And as a result of that experience, I had just something fall into place. And from that point on, I have been binge-free and pretty much able to eat anything that I want. I eat very healthily. I'm a really healthy 74-year-old, and, you know, I'm at a good weight, and it's just not an issue anymore. I can have ice cream if I want it, which I don't very often. So it is possible to get beyond it, even if you feel like, I know I felt for years like I was going to be stuck in jail for my whole life. What I think was extremely helpful for me, I tried everything, every crazy diet, every solid diet, did therapy, you know, a whole bunch of things. Some of them added some helpful pieces. Some of them added some harmful pieces. So you need to be kind of careful in terms of what messages you're allowing in. I found ultimately meditation, I think, was the final piece that helped me put it all together in a really healthy way, because it enabled me to connect with myself and with my body in a deeper way than I ever had. And the spiritual experience happened around just a horrible relapse, which occurred for, you know, an understandable, emotionally horrible experience. But at that night, I just sort of took responsibility that even though there were a lot of, quote, good reasons for me to be doing this, having nothing to do with me, but, you know, my past and experiences and stuff, ultimately, I was the one who could choose whether or not to put inappropriate food or inappropriate amounts of food in my mouth in the next moment. And I was a good person, and I didn't deserve to cause myself that suffering. And that awareness just led me to an ability. I came up with a little trick that worked for me. I made a commitment that as long as I lived in the house that I had moved into, I was not going to binge, period. kept it really simple, and it worked. And then 30-something years ago when I moved to Rochester, I said, as long as I live in Rochester, I'm not going to binge. And it really became a non-issue because the thought of binging now, it just is very distasteful to me. It's not something I would want to do. But, you know, I think we each have to kind of find our own pieces that put it together. But I think meditation is really helpful. Exercise for me in moderation, not crazily, is very helpful. And, you know, working with some people that really are sending out solid messages.
Well, Jane, thank you for the phone call. And I'm going to let Mary Tantillo respond to some of what she's heard. And good luck to you, Jane. Thank you so much. Go ahead, Mary.
Jane, first of all, thank you so much for coming on and for your sweet words. I consider what I do a ministry, really, and not just a career. So thank you for that. But also, I'm so glad you talked about how you can, many of us can terminate having an eating disorder. Not everybody will have it for a lifetime. And I think as we get better treatments, that will be more the case. So glad that you said that. And also, you pointed out that your own healing really stepped up when you reconnected with yourself. The spiritual meditation experience that you had just underscores the importance of helping patients or people in recovery do that reconnecting with self, knowing what we're feeling, knowing what we're valuing, knowing being in our bodies and really being connected is all the internal connections, and then being in connection with others is the other part of that, or God, a higher power, whatever. It seems like that was a big part of what, you know, what you were emphasizing there at the end. So I'm glad that you brought those things up.
Yeah, Mary is the author of a new book. Mary Tantillo, my guest, is the author of a new book, Multifamily Therapy Group for Young Adults with Anorexia Nervosa, Reconnecting for Recovery. And, you know, to Jane's point, Mary, you know, everyone I have literally ever talked to has either worked with you or needed your services speaks of you in nearly sainthood. There's everybody who's got a job anywhere has got some people don't like them. I mean, there's plenty of people don't like me or don't think I do a good job, and that's just life. There's nobody. Everybody thinks that you're just remarkable. And so now this new book, I know it's going to help more people here. And if you don't mind, I want to read a short section and ask you about your approach, because producer Megan Mack and I were talking before the program about the fact that sometimes books written from an academic perspective feel a little removed from how they would be used in practice. And what you have done is you've modeled what conversations might look like between therapists and patients and, you know, with friends involved. And before I read this section here, can you just tell me why you did it that way?
Well, for all the reasons you just said, which is how could I make this with my co-authors accessible to anybody who picked up this book? And I'll tell you, I'm going to credit someone named Jean Baker Miller, who was the pioneering person for relational cultural theory. And she, in our training institutes, would say, if you can't say it in a way that the average person can say it, why are you saying it at all? I used to admire her so much. She would take very complicated psychological concepts, and she would be able to talk to anybody about them. So I was trying to emulate that. And just thought about all the, you know, I pretended I was sitting in the room with a provider who knew nothing and with a family and a patient. How would I want to say this so everyone on the team, everybody, the captains of the team, the patient and the family, and the rest of us who are professionals, how could we all understand this together to be able to move forward? So, and I will say, Evan, and I mean this is going to sound maybe crazy to some people, but like when I was writing some of those vignettes, I'm going to credit the spirit on that, because I look back at some of them now and I was like, yes, certainly being with patients and families who've taught me everything I know was helpful in coming up with those vignettes, but I felt very moved and influenced by the spirit while I was doing that. So all those things came, you know, were going on when I was writing those sections of the book. I just really wanted to make it accessible and understandable.
Let me read a section just as one example, and there's so many different examples. I mean, there's examples of how therapists or family members can appropriately use humor. There's indications for how parents who are feeling guilty about not doing the right things, how they can handle it. And here's an example in which the therapist notices that there is a disconnection between a patient, in this case named Samantha, and her best friend named Lauren, and the patient is having difficulty naming it and sharing the associated thoughts and feelings. And I'm reading from the book now. The therapist attempts to help the patient address the distress she feels about her friend telling the college RA out of concern about her eating disorder. However, Samantha, the patient, is silent and just shakes her head. The therapist then invokes the help of the friend, Lauren, and other patients in the group who may have had similar experiences. And they try to help the patient name what she may be experiencing, but the patient just says, no, she's fine, and what happened is in the past. So here's the conversation modeled in the book. The therapist says, Samantha, it does not seem like you are fine. I want to share with you how heavy my heart feels watching you hold in what are probably some pretty intense emotions. I feel sad and frustrated for you because it seems like you're trying to be a good friend and not upset Lauren with how you feel about what happened. At the same time, good friendship is based on honesty. You both said you value each other. What is the worst thing that will happen if you share what you felt when Lauren spoke about your disorder to the IRA? And Samantha says, I don't want to lose another friend. Lauren says, you are not going to lose me by telling me how you feel. You're probably super annoyed with me, but I was just so worried about you. The therapist says, Samantha, are you feeling super annoyed like Lauren says, or something different? And Samantha says, I just felt betrayed and upset because you told. But I did not want you to tell you this because you could get angry with me and decide not to be my friend, and I've already lost so many other friends at school. End quote. I mean, that is very real, Mary. I mean, that is someone who is a patient who thinks, I've already lost people. I'm hurt by what my friend did, but I cannot risk being honest about my emotions because I can't lose more people. And that has got to be a very difficult position for a patient to be in, Mary.
It is a terrible position. And you know what the eating disorder is saying, you know, when you're feeling vulnerable. Well, you don't really need to, you know, be dealing with that person and all the conflict. You should just avoid it and use me. Go back to the room and binge. Go back to your room and restrict. Just try to numb emotion, right? So it takes a lot for people to be in a group, multifamily group or any other group, and be working on this. And what I was trying to do, and there were several pieces there, Evan, that you brought out, I wanted to make it a safe space for the patient to say what was really going on, because I have an assumption that people really don't necessarily know what's going on in the moment, and I have to help them reconnect with what they're feeling or could be feeling authentically. So that's why I offered myself up as a way of how to do that. So I was modeling for her. I was trying to empathize with her so she could see how I was doing it. So I was sharing with her my bodily experiences, because I want her to practice being in touch with her body, as well as my emotional experiences, and gave them names. Because even when you're an adult with an eating disorder, it's hard to put names to feelings or name your internal state. So I was trying to model that. And then the mutuality part, the going back and forth, which is the healing factor here that I'm trying to promote, it allows her to take in what I've said to her. Well, Mary's experiencing this in her body and emotionally. Is that what I'm experiencing? And the patient might say, well, yeah, I am experiencing this, but I'm also experiencing that. That's why I always say to the patients and families, is it the same or is it different? I want to leave them the option of both, because in general, patients and families have lots of anxiety, and it's easy to agree but harder to disagree with something. So then I provide that option because I want to draw really what's going on. So I model it. I have her take it in. Then she puts it back out between us. It's that back and forth, that mutual empathy, mutual empowerment that I'm going after in that situation. And hopefully that helps her feel more brave, you know, braver, to be able to say with more clarity, yes, this is what I'm feeling, and be able to say it to her friend like she did. She didn't want to lose another friend. She was able to talk about that the stakes were high. But first, you have to start at A, which is hard when you are looking at your daughter or son or your partner with an eating disorder, and they're so bright. Alyssa is a great example of this. She is amazing, like you said, Evan. But, you know, it's hard to believe that person in that moment might not be able to name their feelings. Well, they can't. Having an eating disorder makes it hard to connect up exactly what you're feeling with a word or what your bodily state is. So you got to start there. And then move into the interpersonal plane, like help the person say it to the other person. And all that was going on in that excerpt that you just read. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what Megan and I were talking about before the program. Just it's such a different approach and so much more accessible just to help people who are going to be trying to engage in multifamily therapy group to work through this and to see what the structure is like and to sort of see what some examples are. 30 seconds, Michelle Morales. I know you feel strongly that families have a role here. In 30 seconds, what's the value of this book for families?
Well, it takes a village in order to support someone who has an eating disorder. So this builds the village, and it helps everyone stay connected so the person can move through recovery.
Where is the book available, Mary Tantillo?
It's available directly through Routledge or on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Routledge is publisher, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The book is Multifamily Therapy Group for Young Adults with Anorexia Nervosa, Reconnecting for Recovery. And it will help families. Mary Tantillo, you really are the best, and it's always an honor to have you. Thank you. Thank you very much for what you're doing, Mary.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Alyssa Morales, you are a true role model, and it is our pleasure to talk to you, and here's to continued success. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And Michelle Morales, the same. You're helping so many people in this community. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you for providing this information for everyone.
You got it. What an inspiring hour. What remarkable people. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a beautiful weekend. And we're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.